Welcome everyone to today's Kluwen Seminar. My name is Jean Balance and I'll be serving as your online moderator coming to you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. We're here for the CEC training for OSCs, which will look at access fundamentals, and that's been sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Our primary instructor today will be Andrew Goldman from EPA Region 3. Before I turn things over to him in just a moment, I just want to cover a couple of basic housekeeping items for those participants and give our latecomers just an extra minute or so to hop on the line. If you haven't done so already, please refer back to the registration email you received when you signed up for today's live broadcast. That email will point you to something called the seminar homepage. The seminar homepage has more information about our live broadcast. There are links and contact information for our presenter as well as myself down near the bottom of the page. There are options to download the presentation materials in a variety of formats, and then we have a whole collection of links to other materials that will be discussed today, including a starting movie that we're going to play back in just a few moments, and some other materials that our presenter has pulled together for you. You'll even see a link to provide feedback. But to actually join us for the live broadcast, you're going to want to click the button that says Go to Seminar that appears in the upper left corner of the page. If you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself, and you'll be brought into our fully interactive Adobe Connect environment. Our whole broadcast today will be delivered through Adobe Connect, so you should be able to sit back and watch in real time as well as listen to the entire session through your computer or mobile device. If you have problems joining us online, we do have hard copy materials, again, of the slides and that movie that will be played back, so you can download them and just follow along on the phone lines or play them back locally. We encourage you to try to work with us to help troubleshoot any issues so you can join us for the interactive delivery through Adobe Connect. Again, our speaker will be controlling your movement through the material, so if you wanted to flip through the slides at your own pace, download a copy of the materials from the seminar homepage. Audio is available online for all of our participants right through the Adobe Connect environment. Now is the time to adjust your audio, so if you're having problems hearing me, check your local volume settings and see if you can boost the volume that way. If that doesn't work, some participants say that using a pair of headphones can drastically help improve the volume. Again, if that still doesn't solve your problems, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Simply use the Q&A window in the lower right-hand corner to ask for the call-in number. We will have all of the telephone lines muted, and we would ask that everybody remain on that global mute to help cut down on other background noises and disruptions. Questions can be submitted at any time using the Q&A window in the lower right corner where you should see a welcome message from me. To submit your comment or question, simply click on the empty white box at the bottom of the right-hand corner of your screen and start typing away. Once you're done, either hit enter or press the cartoon bubble to the right, and that will privately submit your comment or question to me. No one else will be able to read your submissions, and when we take breaks for Q&A, I will read questions out loud to our presenter on your behalf so that he can address them. If you have technical problems, remember that Q&A window will be the way to go version to only EPA employees for those that want to join us by replaying the broadcast. So if you're having problems accessing it or want to know exactly when that archive will be available for a colleague to use, please send me an email and I'll work to get you the internal EPA link when we're done with the live broadcast today. If you want to look at the other sessions we've already hosted, we do have about 520 previously recorded seminars on the Kluwen website. I encourage you to take a moment to browse through them. All right, just a gentle reminder, you should see the PowerPoint presentation appear mostly in the left-hand side of your screen. This window may change as we use different materials for today's instruction, but this is the main viewing portion. We will control your motions through the slides. If anything looks too small, click the full screen button that you should see in the upper right corner, and that'll blow up the slides on your end. To shrink them back down to see the other windows, simply click the full screen button again. On the right-hand side, you're going to see a collection of boxes, starting with our Kluwen logo in the upper right-hand corner. Just below that, you're going to see the related URLs box. Those are active hyperlinks. So when our instructor references materials, movies, or other resources, if I talk about how to get to the seminar homepage or provide feedback, all of those are found under related URLs. Simply click on the link of interest and press the Browse to button to open them locally on your computer. And then below that is that all-important Q&A window. You can type up your questions and comments here, and click the little cartoon bubble or hit enter to privately submit them. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our instructor, Andrew Goldman, who's joining us from EPA Region 3. Andy?
Okay, Jean, can you hear me?
I can.
Excellent. I assume that everyone else can as well. As Jean indicated, I'm Andy Goldman. I'm with EPA Region 3's Office of Regional Council. I've been here since 1987, working primarily in Superfund. As a preliminary matter, I want to thank the folks who invited me here to speak to you this afternoon about access. I also want to thank the folks who've set it all up, all the technical things. Jean, Austin, Therese, you know who you are. Without you, it wouldn't be possible. And I want to thank everyone for joining in. This webinar is open to any and all EPA employees. Now, I haven't seen the list of participants, and I'm not sure the mix of program folks versus attorneys versus anything else, but at the outset, note that the presentation is aimed primarily at EPA on-scene coordinators. But the message is universal and not exclusive to Superfund removal work. For those of you who are working in other programs, I believe there is useful information in here that you can apply in your own worlds. Now, this is the first time I've done this presentation via a webinar. I've done it many times before a live audience. Before a live audience, I can see furrowed brows, evidence of confusion, disagreement, and disgust. I can see who's awake and who's asleep, but I don't have that ability now. I am told, and Jean had said, you can ask questions, and Jean, you should feel free to interrupt me. Because of my setup here, I'm looking at a panel across the room, so I'm not looking at the box with questions, so I won't see them when they come up, so please, at any time, just interrupt me. With that, I'd like to alert you to the handouts, handouts that you would have received had you been a live audience, but which I understand Jean has put up on the interweb in some place that you can access. And Jean, do you want to take a second just to explain where that is?
Absolutely. All of the handouts that will be referenced are available in two locations. For those of you that are joining us in the live Adobe Connect room, that will open up a website where you can download all of the files and resources that Andy's going to talk about today, in addition to the seminar slides and even the movie we're going to play back. For those that aren't actively in the Adobe Connect room and you're just following along with a hard copy of the materials, again, you'll find those materials from the seminar homepage. You can click the links button, and that'll pull up the very same collection of online resources, movies, and presentation materials that Andy will discuss today.
Okay, thanks very much, Jean. The handouts that Jean alluded to consist of seven things. A copy of the PowerPoint presentation, a copy of CERCLA 104E, which is the source of our access authority, a copy of Section 300.400D of the NCP, a copy of EPA Delegation 14-6, both headquarters and Region 3's, a copy of EPA's access guidance documents, a sample consent form that we use here in EPA Region 3, and then a rather complicated entry agreement that we negotiated with a railroad in EPA Region 3. If you are unable to find these, you know how to get a hold of Gene. All right, but for the next 2 hours, I suspect, I'll be speaking about access fundamentals, entering private property to do the work of the government. Most of you are online here because you periodically need to make entry to private property to perform your work. What I hope to do in the next 2 hours is give you a framework for thinking about how to do this properly so you can focus on your response work without worrying about the consequences of improper access. The big takeaway from this presentation, the two things that you should, you know, if you're going to forget everything, don't forget these two things. Thing number one, government officials may not enter private property unless they have authority to do so. And two, government officials who enter private property without authority adversely affect EPA's interests and may subject themselves to personal liability. And you will see these two things later on. All right, well, let's get this works. It does. Since most learning about the law comes from watching Criminal Minds and CSI New York, I'm going to start with a three-minute clip that some of you may recognize. Now, we've tested this and it works, but if you see nothing, hear nothing, if it jitters, just stay tuned. The clip is about 3 minutes long. And I suspect that if it doesn't work for you, once it's over, you will continue to be connected. So I will ask Jean to run the clip now.
Yes, Inspector. The district attorney has been wanting to talk to you. It's Inspector Callahan.
Have him come in, please.
Will you come this way, Inspector? May I?
I'll be done in a minute. Have a seat. I've just been looking over your arrest report. A very unusual piece of police work. Really amazing.
Yeah, well, I had some luck.
You're lucky I'm not indicting you for assault with intent to commit murder.
What?
Where the hell does it say you've got a right to kick down doors, torture suspects, deny medical attention and legal counsel? Where have you been? Does Escobedo ring a bell? Miranda? I mean, you must have heard of the Fourth Amendment. What I'm saying is that man had rights.
Well, I'm all broken up about that man's rights.
You should be. I've got news for you, Callahan. As soon as he's well enough to leave the hospital, he walks.
What are you talking about?
He's free.
And you're letting him go?
We have to. We can't try him.
And why is that?
Because I'm not wasting $500,000 of the taxpayers' money on a trial we can't possibly win. The problem is we don't have any evidence.
Evidence? What the hell do you call that?
I call it... This rifle might make a nice souvenir. But it's inadmissible as evidence.
And who says that?
It's the law.
Well, then the law is crazy.
This is Judge Bannerman of the appellate court. He also holds classes in constitutional law at Berkeley. I've asked him for an opinion. Your Honor?
Well, in my opinion, the search of the suspect's quarters was illegal. Evidence obtained thereby, such as that hunting rifle, for instance, is inadmissible in court. You should have gotten a search warrant.
Okay. Let me turn down. Gene, can you still hear me?
I can still hear you, and we're pulling yourself right back up.
Excellent. All right, for those of you who could not see or hear the clip, I'll give you the 30-second rundown. It was a clip from Dirty Harry, a 1971 police movie. In the scene, Inspector Callahan, played by Clint Eastwood, meets with the district attorney and gets reamed out because Inspector Callahan kicked down doors, denied access to counsel, and tortured a suspect to get evidence to support his case. Well, the district attorney and a judge who just happened to be in the room tell Harry that his case is gone because he ignored the law. The evidence collected could not be used, and the suspect went free. All right, now I'm going to try to advance the slide. And it's not working. There we go. All right, a couple of things to take from the movie clip. Harry Callahan thought he was doing a good job when he busted down a door, tortured a suspect, and denied access to counsel. He dismissed the idea that the suspect had rights or that his authority was limited in any way. And he was surprised to learn that disregarding the suspect's rights or ignoring his own authority might impact, or in this case, destroy his case. Now, I'm not saying that OSCs typically conduct themselves like Dirty Harry, but seeing the clip gives us an important perspective on the role of the law and what we do. Well, what our friend Harry Callahan missed at the most basic level was this. Government officials may act only if authorized to act, and two, there are consequences to acting outside a government official's authority. Well, what are the consequences of acting outside your authority? In Harry Callahan's world, clearly the most significant was exclusion of the evidence. The gun was inadmissible, and the suspect would be released. Well, Superfund is primarily a civil statute, not a criminal one. We typically need not be concerned with the exclusion of evidence, but the possibility exists that the regulated community brings this up. In the context of Superfund, I've identified four possible consequences of exceeding your authority. The first of which is our ability to recover costs may be compromised. One way we get things done in the Superfund program is to spend fund money and later sue the PRPs for reimbursement. statute permits us to recover all costs not inconsistent with the NCP. Well, the NCP contains lots of provisions dealing with the manner in which we'll study a site, the manner in which we'll select a removal action, and language indicating that a removal must be terminated after $2 million has been spent or 12 months have elapsed unless certain findings are made. Let's say you are an OSC conducting a removal, and you're at your $2 million ceiling, and you need to spend an additional, we sue for $2,150,000. $150,000 above that $2 million ceiling is at risk because EPA did not comply with the NCP requirement for exceeding the ceiling. So compromising our cost recovery authority is one consequence of exceeding your authority. Spending that $150,000 above your ceiling wasn't supposed to have happened. Another consequence of acting without authority, the United States may be subject to counterclaims. Recall that one of the four categories of responsible parties liable to reimburse the government's costs is a person who arranged for the disposal of hazardous substances that are found at the site. Let's say you're directing a fund lead removal action calling for off-site disposal of drummed waste at a landfill. You're nearing the end of the project, you've got no money left, you don't want to ask for more funding, so you poke holes in the top of the drums and dump the contents into the already contaminated landfill. We later sue the PRPs for cost recovery. The defendants counterclaim against the United States, arguing that we arranged for the disposal of hazardous substances at the site. There would be traction there. They could potentially win. Now, exceeding your authority by not following what was in the action memo, off-site disposal of the drummed waste, has subjected the United States to a counterclaim, which distracts us from prosecuting the cost recovery action, shows the judge that EPA has been sloppy and may have made other mistakes, and may offset the amount of our cost recovery. Now we need to involve DOJ defense, and things get more complicated for us. We don't want to be in that position. So let's avoid drawing a counterclaim. Another possible consequence, all right, we lost the ability to advance. Here we go. Other agency actions rendered suspect and subjected to increased scrutiny. Go back to the example where the OSC ignored the $2 million ceiling. The PRPs in the court are more likely to scrutinize every action that we have taken and every document that we've issued, every action memo, every endangerment determination, any extension to your funding and timing limits, records of decisions in the remedial world. This intensifies the litigation team's efforts in cost recovery and shifts the balance from prosecuting that cost recovery claim to defending our actions, and we don't want to be there. And the last consequence is personal liability. A couple of minutes ago, I showed you that the United States can be sued when you've exceeded your authority. You can be sued as well. An example, an on-scene coordinator enters the site improperly. The owner sues the OSC in his individual capacity for violating the owner's constitutional rights. We're now talking about your house, your cars, your speedboats, not the assets of the U.S. government. This is scary, it has happened, and I want you to know how to avoid this. I believe on November 20th, Cliff Villa from Region 10 will deliver a presentation via webinar, I believe from 1 to 3 Eastern, that goes into detail about personal liability and how we deal with it. But for now, I'd like you to take note of the fact that personal liability is another potential consequence of exceeding your authority. Well, where do we look to see if your actions are consistent with your authority? Well, a number of sources will authorize actions, limit or condition those actions, or prohibit certain actions. And they are the U.S. Constitution and case law interpreting the Constitution, the Superfund statute and the case law interpreting that, delegations, the National Contingency Plan, policy guidance documents, and site-specific documents. And I want to look at each in some detail. First, we have the U.S. Constitution. You all remember this from grade school. It defines the relationship between the U.S. government and the citizens. But it doesn't mention OSCs or RPMs or Superfund. It doesn't tell us how to clean up a landfill or a contaminated water supply. But its contents have a huge impact on the authority that we're given in the manner in which that authority is exercised. But one of the numerous provisions of the text which impacts the operations of the federal government is the Fourth Amendment, which reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated." Well, judicial interpretation of those 24 words impacts what we can and cannot do over 200 years after these words were written. One of the most telling interpretations of these words comes from a 1948 case from the U.S. Supreme Court called Johnson versus the United States. And in that case, the Supreme Court wrote, "The right of officers to thrust themselves into a home is also a grave concern not only to the individual, but to a society which chooses to dwell in reasonable security and freedom from surveillance. When the right," I want to read that last part again because it's in yellow. "When the right of privacy must reasonably yield to the right of search is, as a rule, to be decided by a judicial officer, not by a policeman or government enforcement agent." Guess which category we fall into. What does this mean to us? Well, with certain exceptions that I will briefly mention later on, in order to enter private property to perform Superfund work in a manner that is consistent with the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, you will need either consent from the owner or judicial approval. And without consent or judicial approval, you may subject EPA and or yourself to adverse consequences. That's the Constitution for the most part. That's what we need to pay attention to from a constitutional standpoint. All right. Next, the Superfund statute itself. In passing the statute, Congress gave the executive branch certain powers and authorities in the area of hazardous waste cleanup. By now, all the response from the PRPs. But the statute also authorizes entry to private property, and the relevant provisions, the full-blown text, are in the handouts, which are up in that space on the web. And the four relevant provisions are CERCLA 104E1 and 3, which discusses entry, 106, which talks about other entry authority. Now, it's clear the statute authorizes access, but not just to any property at any time for any reason. If it did, we wouldn't have a page and a half of things: who is authorized to enter, where such persons can go, when we may enter, what we can enter for, what conditions must exist for our entry authority to be triggered, and what we can do if the owner says no. We need to read and be familiar with what the statute says about all of this in order to understand what our statutory access authority is. Well, luckily, I have boiled this down for you. The statute tells us who is authorized to enter. That's the first column of the chart. It says any officer, employee, or representative of the president duly designated by the president. The statute tells us where such persons can go, and I will paraphrase that second column. It's a place where a release is or may be threatened, a place where entry is needed to determine the need for response or effectuate that response, and any property that's adjacent to any of these other locations. That's where we're able to enter. Column three, that the statute tells us when we may enter at reasonable times. Column 4, the statute tells us what we can enter for, only for purposes of determining the need for response, choosing or taking response, or otherwise enforcing the provisions of CERCLA. And the statute imposes certain requirements and conditions on our entry. That's in Column 5. We have to have a reasonable basis to believe that there may be a release or a threat of release of a hazardous substance or a pollutant or contaminant. So you can see that while the statute authorizes entry, it imposes conditions and limits on that action. And if these limits and conditions are not met, our entry authority is not triggered. And if entry is nonetheless made, the entering official may subject EPA and him or herself to adverse consequences. Well, the statute also specifically authorizes inspections and sampling. Again, not just anywhere at any time for any purpose. The statute tells us who is authorized to enter and inspect, and that's column one, the same listing as is true for entry. The statute tells us where such persons can enter and inspect, the same list as for entry. The statute tells us what we can enter, what we can inspect and sample for what purposes, the same purposes that we have for entry. And the statute imposes certain additional requirements and conditions on inspections and sampling. In addition to the reasonable basis to believe, which we need to enter the property anyway, the statute requires that the inspection must be completed with reasonable promptness. The official must give the owner, operator, tenant, or other person in charge a receipt describing samples obtained, and if requested, a portion of each sample. That's the split sampling requirement. And also, we have to give a copy of the results promptly. So again, while the statute authorizes inspections and sampling, it imposes conditions and limits on these actions. And if these limits and conditions are not met, our inspection and sampling authority is not triggered. If you inspect and sample and do not comply with these limits and conditions, you may subject EPA and or yourselves to personal or adverse consequences. Well, the statute also tells us what we can do if the owner says no when asked to consent to the entry. The top row of this box speaks about issuing an administrative order directing the owner to provide access. The statute tells us when we can do that. If consent is not granted regarding any request made by an officer, employee, or representative for entry or for inspections or sampling. The statute also tells us who is authorized to issue that order, the president. The statute tells us what we can order, compliance with our request. And the statute imposes other requirements for issuance of the order. The order has to be issued after a notice and opportunity for consultation, as is reasonably appropriate under the circumstance. Now here's a little test. Remember, we talked about the Fourth Amendment, and the Fourth Amendment case that I referred to says that government enforcement agents don't get to decide when the right of privacy must yield. Only the courts do. What it means is that an order is nothing more than a very loud voice asking the owner to consent at the peril of penalties if he or she does not. If the owner does not agree to comply with the order, we do not have access that satisfies the Fourth Amendment. All right, that's administrative orders, the top box. The statute also allows us to seek court orders in 104E5 from Article 3 courts. The statute tells us when we're authorized to do that. Again, if consent is not granted regarding a request, the statute tells us who can seek that relief, the president. The statute tells us what we can do, ask the attorney general to commence a civil action to compel compliance with our request or the administrative order that we issued pursuant to the authority described in the top box. And the statute also provides directions to the court with what to do with the lawsuit. How it works is that we request consent for access. The owner says no. We refer the matter to DOJ. DOJ files a complaint against the owner. The owner gets to answer that complaint. There may be a hearing, discovery, trial, an appeal. And at the end of the day, we hope to get a piece of paper signed by the judge, which is the judicial approval called for by the Fourth Amendment. That's the other statutorily authorized response to, no, you may not enter my property. Now, note that the administrative order and the court order that are described on this screen spring forth from CERCLA. Congress gave the president these authorities in CERCLA. But Congress didn't stop there. It went further. In 104E6, the other authority provision, Congress said, nothing in this subsection shall preclude the president from securing access or obtaining information in any other lawful manner. Well, this is the provision on which we rely in pursuing administrative warrants. A warrant is a particularly convenient and efficient way of getting judicial approval. It's nothing more than a piece of paper signed by a federal magistrate authorizing our entry to private property. What sets it apart from the court order that I spoke about moments ago is the process that we use to obtain it. We don't file a complaint against the owner. The owner does not get an opportunity to appear before or otherwise speak to the court or to EPA. Now, I've delivered in the past an in-depth presentation covering warrants in more detail, what they are, how we get them, and your role in that process. And you do have a very big role in the warrant process, all of which is beyond the scope of today's webinar. But if you want to hear more about it, lobby the webinar folks to invite me to talk about warrants. But for now, realize that the Superfund statute specifically authorizes us to seek administrative warrants to enter private property. That's in addition to the administrative order and Article 3 court order and consent, of course. So we spoke a little bit about the Constitution, a little bit about the statute. What else? We have delegations. Congress passes laws authorizing the president to act. Look at your copy of CERCLA's entry authority in the handouts, and you'll see that Congress authorizes the president to enter, inspect, and take samples. Well, how does the statute authorizing the president to enter, inspect, and take samples allow you, OSC's RPM, the persons down the agency food chain who will execute that authority? And in the Superfund context, Congress authorized the president to investigate and respond to releases, including authority to enter, inspect, and take samples. In Executive Order 12580, the president delegated many of these authorities given to him by Congress, including entry, inspections, and sampling, to the administrator of EPA. But does the administrator go out with a shovel and take samples? I've never seen that. We need more. In EPA Delegation 14-6, the administrator delegated entry, inspections, and sampling authority to the regional administrators. Well, I ask again, how many of you seen your regional administrators go out with a shovel to take a sample? I know that mine does not. We need more. Each region has regional redelegations of headquarters delegated authorities. So you in your regions will all have a region blank 14-6 in which entry, inspection, and sampling authority have hopefully been delegated down to you. Now you need to check the delegation chain to connect yourselves to the presidential authority, noting that the executive order, the headquarters delegation, and all of your own regional delegations all contain limits and conditions on the exercise of those authorities. The delegations typically parrot the limits and conditions of the statute, but you need to read them to make sure. In Region 3, a long time ago, our delegation used to require consultation with the Office of Regional Counsel prior to making any entry to private property. We found this to be ridiculous and onerous because most entries are made by agreement without counsel involvement, so we needed to change it. So make sure that you're familiar with the conditions and limits in your own regional redelegation of 14-6. All right, we've looked at the Constitution, the statute, and delegations. What's next? We have the NCP. The NCP is a regulation, a law generated by the executive branch, not by Congress. It's a restatement and interpretation of existing authority provided by Congress. It can impose limits on authority that Congress did not include in the statute. Now, all of our actions in the Superfund world revolve around the NCP. Section 104 of CERCLA, that is where we get all of our response and investigatory authority from, 104 says we can act consistent with the NCP to conduct removal or remedial actions. Section 107 of the statute says that we can recover costs incurred in a manner not inconsistent with the NCP. So we have to look to the NCP for further instruction on the scope and limits of our entry authority. And as we can see, the NCP in fact addresses access in Section 300.400D. A couple of comments about that. For the most part, the NCP language tracks the statutory language with a couple of minor variations. It also introduces the notion that the lead agency can designate others, including PRPs, when they're under an agreement with us, as our representatives solely for purposes of access. This is a more than a minor difference. The NCP says that EPA may issue an order under 104E5, that's the administrative order we talked about, if consent has been conditioned in any way. Recall back on the chart, the administrative order authority is triggered if consent has been denied. Well, the NCP equates denial of a consent with the imposition of conditions for consent. That's pretty considerable. And finally, the NCP prescribes certain requirements for inclusion in access orders. Certain provisions need to be spelled out in the orders in order for the orders to be valid. So we need to look again at the NCP to see what our authority is and to stay within the lanes. So we talked about the Constitution, the statute, the delegations, and the NCP. What's next? We have policy and guidance. Guidance is not law. Through guidance, we explain how the agency people will administer the agency's authority. In the area of access, we have two documents, a 1987 access document and a 2010 clarification document that actually my supervisor, Heather Gray, here in Region 3, kickstarted. Both of these access documents are in the handouts on the web. A couple of points from the guidance document. One, consent is the preferred means of getting access. We will almost always try this first, if the property owner can be found, that is. Well, you're absolutely right. We need judicial approval, which, of course, can be time-consuming. Another point from the guidance, if consent is denied, do not threaten the property owner with penalties or monetary liability, and do not make remarks which could be construed as threatening. Well, how then do we communicate that we have authority, power, and leverage in this situation? Well, I counsel OSCs in the past that you can describe the process that we have available to us. If the property owner denies consent, we can take other steps. We can issue a unilateral order, we can get a warrant, we can file an action for a court order, and all of these things will drive up our costs. And if you happen to be a PRP that we pursue in cost recovery, it's going to be a bigger bill to pay. In addition to that, if the landowner enjoys bona fide prospective purchaser status or thinks they may have an innocent landowner defense, or may be able to take advantage of the continuous landowner status, all of which insulate landowners from liability, they stand to lose that status if they say no and do not cooperate with our request for access. So don't say you're going to go to jail or we're going to hit you for $1 billion, but you can describe the implications of the denial of access. Three, you should not agree to conditions to consent. Specifically, conditions which impede or restrict your response, conditions which impose indemnity or compensatory obligations, or provisions which provide a release of liability. Generally speaking, we make no real concessions when it comes to access. The statute provides us with unencumbered access, and the NCP says that conditions constitute a denial. That said, in most cases, we make what I call costless concessions. Things like advance notice prior to entry, providing a copy of an insurance certificate evidencing the coverage that our contractors have, providing a copy of the sampling analysis plan to the owner, things like this. In a few cases that I'll talk about later, we make much larger safety-related concessions, but I'll get to that.
Andy, we do have a question that came in online.
Sure.
One of our participants would like to know, when can you get access authorization signed by a tenant?
We will get to that. That's a very good question. Stay tuned. I will cover that. All right. We talked about the Constitution, the statute, delegations, regulations, policy, and guidance. What's next? Site-specific documents. An example of a site-specific document, an action memo. We all know that's a document by which a person authorized to select a removal action authorizes the expenditure of a specific amount of money for a specific removal action. For example, $750,000 to remove and dispose of chemical drums on the site. The OSC can't spend any more money. The OSC can't do anything else. Well, in the area of access, a site-specific document might look like the document on the left. Dear EPA, you or any of your agencies have no permission to set foot on my property, even to deliver a notice. Well, that's a pretty good indication that we do not have consent. That's a site-specific document that tells you what your access status is as of your receipt of that letter. Another example of an access-related site-specific document is the one on the right. That's a warrant issued by a federal magistrate telling EPA that we do have access to the property. Now, site-specific documents, like the warrant on the right, may authorize entry, but limit or condition the entry by saying that we have entry during certain times, for specific purposes, or for a specific duration of time. And if we don't abide by those limits, and you're still on the property, you're acting outside the scope of your authority, and you may trigger the consequences that we talked about before. All right. So now you know that there are consequences for acting beyond the scope of your authority. You know that the dimensions of your authority to enter can't be appreciated without understanding a little bit about the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, a little bit about CERCLA 104E, a little bit about CERCLA Delegation 14-6, both headquarters and your own regional delegation, a little bit about NCP Section 300.400D, EPA's access guidance documents, and site-specific documents. Are you now experts capable of getting access to all manner of properties by yourselves? I see all of you shaking your heads over the interweb. Of course not. No more than Harry Callahan was prepared to do everything necessary to bring his suspect to justice. Like Harry Callahan, you have lawyers at your disposal to discuss any and all questions you might have about access both before you leave for the field and when you are in the field. Most regions have lawyers on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for this purpose. Don't hesitate to use them when you've got questions or concerns about the legitimacy of your entry authority. Contact counsel when authority is in doubt. All right. We spent a lot of time now, 45 minutes, talking about theory, the law, and what it requires. Now I want to talk about practice, how you actually get access you need. And the first concept I want to cover is preparing to get access. These are the things that you need in order to think about before you begin knocking on doors, whether those doors are the doors of the private property owner or the door of your own attorney. When I train the attorneys on access, I tell them, you've got to drill the OSCs on all of these issues if and when they come in for access help. And the first one is, identify the reasonable basis to believe there may be a release or a threatened release of a hazardous substance or pollutant or contaminant. Why do we care about this? Remember, both the statute and the NCP say we need this in order to enter private property or to inspect property or to take samples from property. You need to articulate this ahead of time in your own head so you can explain it to the property owner if they're sophisticated enough to know to ask about it, or you can explain it to your attorney if you need your attorney's help in getting access, or so you can identify it in a unilateral order if we need to issue one. Identification of the reasonable basis is one of those things that the NCP says must be spelled out in the order. So before you seek access, take stock of the hazardous substances, pollutants, and contaminants, the media that are affected, the history of operations at the site, and any other relevant information that's going to assist you in forming a reasonable basis to believe that there is a release or a threatened release of a hazardous substance or pollutant or contaminant. Note, though, that the location of the release or threatened release need not be the property where you are now seeking entry. Consider a dry cleaner on parcel A and a daycare on parcel B. You want access to parcel B to test the groundwater. Well, to satisfy this requirement, this reasonable basis requirement, you can rely on your reasonable basis to believe that there's a release on parcel A, so long as parcel B is one of those properties where entry is authorized under the statute. So identification of your reasonable basis to believe is the first thing you need to do before you consider going down the access road. Number two, make sure the property where access is sought is described in Circular 104E1A. But getting you to think about this in advance gets you in the practice of thinking about the limits on your access authority and gets you to identify all of the parcels where entry is needed, keeping in mind that different parcels may be owned by different people. Remember, property boundary lines are political. They are arbitrary. The contamination doesn't stop just because it hits one of these artificial boundaries. You're going to want to follow the contamination wherever it goes, and you're going to need access to each property, and so you'll need access to enter, inspect, and take samples from the owner of each property where that contamination is found. So you're going to need to identify each one of those parcels in advance and consider whether it's on this list. Okay, make sure that the purposes of entry are permitted by CERCLA. Remember that the permitted purposes are determining the need for response, choosing a response, taking a response, or otherwise enforcing the provisions of CERCLA. If you call me up on a 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon and you tell me you've got a warehouse that's on fire and there's a green gas cloud drifting to the property next door, and the property next door just happens to be a daycare with kids in the yard, and that the fire chief asked you to enter the warehouse property, I'm going to say, wait a minute, why do you want to enter? That the fire chief asked you to enter isn't enough. Tell me what you want to do on the property so that we can figure out if it falls within the permitted purposes, determining the need for response, choosing or taking a response, or otherwise enforcing CERCLA. Okay, identify persons with authority to consent to enter. Consent is no good if it's given by a person with no authority to give it. The easy case is a 2-year-old who opens the door. The harder case actually happened in Region 3 in a case that drew lawsuits against EPA, the administrator of EPA, the regional administrator of EPA Region 3, the OSC, and civil investigators in their personal capacities, I'll add. And in that case, the OSC knocked on a door to a house located outside a fenced area. A 1,000-year-old man answered the door. The OSC asked how he could get access to the fenced area. The old man spins around, disappears for 10 minutes, and comes back with a key. Well, the OSC, the civil investigator, and the contractors then entered through the gate, drove a mile up the road, encountered a second gate for which they did not have a key, jumped the fence, and took samples inside that second enclosed area. It turns out that the old man used to own the property, but sold it to the company. The company let the man live in the house and gave him a key to fence number one so we could store his junk inside that fence line. The court rejected our argument that we should be entitled to rely on the old man's actions in giving us the key, because diligence on our part would have revealed to EPA that the old man did not own the property, and embarrassingly, actually in the briefcase of the OSC was a newspaper article in which it was reported that the property was sold to the big bad company. So the big bad company then sued us. So the first question to ask at the door is, are you authorized to prevent entry so we can do what it is that you want to enter for? Actually, before you get to the door is, you want to try to figure out who that person might be. Okay. Actually, let's not go there yet. This is where we get to the landlord-tenant issue, and I'm glad somebody brought that up. Many properties are owned by one person or entity, that's the landlord, and occupied by another, the tenant. And the question is, from whom should you get consent? Well, it's a complex question which turns on a couple of factors: where you want to go on the property, what you want to do, and what each person's reasonable expectation of privacy is. And for the lawyers who may be on the phone, that is the litmus test of the Fourth Amendment. It exists to protect a person's reasonable expectation of privacy. In many cases, the landlord completely relinquishes control of the property to the tenant, and therefore the landlord has no reasonable expectation of privacy in the property anymore. However, there may be certain instances in which the landlord has retained this expectation. You're going to want to discuss the issue with your lawyers to make an informed decision on the right person to ask. But I do have some general guidelines. If you have the option, get consent from both. You'll be better protected. If you can only get consent from one, you have a better chance of being okay if you get the tenant's consent. Need access to areas where the tenant doesn't have clear access. For example, a locked, fenced area where the tenant doesn't have keys. Perhaps that second enclosure in the case that I described would fall into that category. The second example, you need to conduct work to which the tenant does not have clear authority to consent. For example, demolition of a building. It's highly unlikely that the tenant would have the authority to destroy or to agree to the destruction of the landlord's asset. Another example would be vapor intrusion sampling, where you're going to poke a hole through the foundation of the building to sample the soil gas below. It's questionable that the tenant would have the authority to allow you to put a hole through the foundation. So you'd want to get access from both of them for that. And the third example where I would think you probably want to get access from both, you need access for a period of time that's longer than the tenant's lease. Remember that the tenant loses the authority to consent when he or she loses possession under the lease. If you're working on a project that's, say, a year or two long, and you catch wind of the fact that the tenant is moving out, well, you're in trouble if you haven't gotten access from the owner as well, because as soon as that tenant moves out, your access disappears. So hopefully that addresses the landlord issue in a nutshell. You really do want to consult with your lawyers in more detail about getting access to a property where you do have a landlord and a tenant. Okay, identify the time and duration for which entry is sought. For how long do you need access to the property? What hours of the day do you expect to be there? Well, the NCP says we need to include this information in UAOs. That's the duration that the NCP requires be there. Your lawyer is going to need this information in order to seek court orders or warrants. But beyond all the legalities here, what you're looking for is informed consent. You want to provide the owner with all of the information that's relevant to his or her decision to consent at the time you ask. You don't want the owner to be surprised when you show up to dig at 3 a.m. for 200 days in a row. Surprise increases the likelihood of revocation of consent, something they are able to do, meaning that you lose access and have to start over. So be prepared to tell the owner or your lawyer in general terms the time and duration of the entry that you need. Okay, number six, identify persons for whom entry will be sought. Who's going to go with you? Contractors, state personnel, other agency personnel, ATSDR. Estimate the number of people, generally describe their positions, but don't box yourselves in. Some people absolutely hate their state governments, and if you get access and show up with your state counterpart and they learn that the state counterpart is there, they might revoke consent, in which case you have to start over. So in a general way, identify the folks for whom entry will be sought. It's part of getting informed consent. Identify the areas for which the entry will be sought. This is different from identifying the parcels themselves. You may have access to the parcel, but is entry to the barn on the parcel included? Is entry to the closet in the barn on the parcel included? What about entry to the file cabinet in the closet in the barn on the parcel? The question's going to be, what did the owner consent to? And if you've searched an area where the owner claims he or she did not consent, we might be at risk. So consider in advance of entry whether you want to go into buildings, search in the sewer pipes, search offices, that type of thing. Conveying this information to the owner will reduce the surprise and the possibility of a revocation. Conveying it to your lawyer will arm him or her with the information they need to ask a judge for the access that you want. Identify the access. Yes.
Yes, sir. We did have two questions that came in online.
Sure.
And this one, I'm sorry, I should have interrupted you earlier, but one of our participants just wanted to confirm that verbal and not written signed access is okay in some circumstances.
The answer to that is yes, and we will get there. Oral consent is acceptable, and I will show you how that works in a few moments.
Okay, and then the next participant asks, are credentials necessary for access or at the time of actual entry onto the property? And if that's the case, what type of credentials do they need to bring with them?
Well, the law does not specifically nothing in the law, the NCP, or our guidance documents speaks to the subject of credentials. But if there is going, or you expect there to be any question from the property owner regarding who you are, you know, are you who you say you are, it might be a good idea to carry credentials. I know that there are official-looking credentials that some inspectors in some programs carry. I'm not sure if on-scene coordinators carry such credentials. If they do, it might be a wise thing to keep it in the truck. If you don't have that, you know, even your building pass with your face on it may suffice. The issue is convincing the property owner that you are a representative of EPA, but there's no legal requirement for carrying the credentials.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Okay, number 8, identify the activities to be performed. Are you going to dig 10,000 holes in the front yard? Are you going to excavate 30 feet deep in the backyard? Are you going to demo the garage? You're going to need to know this when you talk to the owner to get the consent that you're looking for. You're going to need to know this when you talk to your lawyer to get help. Be prepared to discuss the work that you want to do. And remember, if it's not included in the access that you get, you're going to need to go back to get it later if you haven't included it. So it's best to think about all of your access needs up front. But don't box yourselves in with language. Describe the work in specific enough terms that the owner is going to know what you're going to do. For example, take surface and subsurface soil samples on the property, or excavate surface and subsurface soil above 500 ppm lead, that type of thing. But don't overdo it on the specificity, because that might come back to bite you. For example, if you get consent to take 5 surface and 5 subsurface samples in the front yard, suppose you need 6. You've got to go back to the owner to get permission for that 6. Suppose you get permission to excavate surface and subsurface soil above 500 ppm with a backhoe. Well, suppose you want to use a shovel. You're going to have to go back to the owner for consent. Newer OSCs should talk with experienced OSCs to get a sense of how to properly describe the work in your requests. Your lawyers can help you identify the work in written access documents. The point is that you should be able to identify the work before the work that you need to do on each property where access is going to be sought before you go out into the field. All right, identify the equipment that's going to be brought onto the property. Remember, the owner probably doesn't have familiarity with the work or the equipment that will be used. You don't want to surprise the owner by showing up with a huge drill rig on an enormous truck that's going to be there for 2 weeks. Be prepared to discuss with the owner or your lawyer, in general terms, the equipment that you're going to bring, keeping in mind that even the lawyers may not be familiar with the equipment. Okay. Check to see if EPA already has access for the work that you need to perform. Much or most of the time, OSCs will be making entry onto private property where EPA has not entered before. But in some cases, there may be a history of dealing with the property and an existing agreement or other arrangement that covers the entry you need. A prior agreement, a prior administrative order, a prior court order, or an existing land covenant. It's not very likely that these will be in play, but you should check with your lawyer to be sure, especially if you're not the first OSC on the site or the site is or has been through the remedial program. All right. That's the end of the list. Once you've considered and can articulate your reasonable basis to believe that there's a release or a threat, you've confirmed that all the parcels you need to enter are covered by CERCLA, you've confirmed that the purpose of your entry is legitimate under CERCLA, You've identified people with authority to consent to the entry. You know how long you need access for. You generally know who you're going to bring with you. You know where on the property you're going to go, what activities you're going to be performing, and what equipment you're going to be bringing with you. You're now ready to pursue access. Well, how do you get it? Well, these are your access tools. We have, and on the top box on the first column, those are the tools that we have at our disposal. Oral consent, written consent, unilateral administrative orders, court orders, and warrants. And I'm going to talk about each one specifically, and I'll keep this chart up on the screen. First, I'll talk about oral consent. Oral consent is a license to enter property. It's permission that can be revoked. We have no interest in the property like an easement or a lease or a deed. There's no contract that can be enforced if they revoke. An example of a license: the Girl Scouts come to your door and they want to show you the cookies they have for sale. You invite them in for purposes of showing you the cookies they have for sale. You can kick them out at will because you no longer have interest in looking at the cookies. You've given them a license to come into your property, and you're capable of revoking that license. Advantages to oral consent: it's fast. It can be readily modified. You just go back to the person and speak with them. And we can do this oral consent without any involvement by EPA headquarters, what you said versus what he heard. Another disadvantage: it's revocable and we have no recourse. We can't march into court and say, but he said we have access. That doesn't work with a license. It is not enforceable. How do we get oral consent? Well, go to the first column of the bottom box. You're going to contact the person authorized to consent. You're going to advise them of the time, duration, personnel, locations you want to go, all the good stuff that we talked about moments ago. And then you're going to make a memo to the file to document that that contact has been made. And that's how you'll get oral consent to enter the property. Next is written consent. It, too, is a license to enter property. It's permission that can be revoked. There's, again, no interest in the property. Even though it is written down and signed, it's not an easement, it's not a lease, it's not a deed. It does not give rise to a legal property interest. It's also not a contract that can be enforced if it's revoked. An example of a written consent might be your ticket to the World Series. You flip that ticket over, and you see in the two-point PICA print all the terms and conditions that they've imposed on your license to be in the stadium. And if you violate any one of them, they can take you out of the stadium. They can revoke that consent, but it is written. The advantages of written consent: it is fast. The consenting party will know exactly what they're agreeing to, at least possibly more so than with oral consent. It can be readily modified. You just will prepare a new written consent form. And we can do it without any assistance from headquarters or the Department of Justice. The same disadvantage applies to written consent as for oral consent. It is revocable, and we have no recourse. How do you get written consent? You're going to contact a person. This is the second box, second column on the bottom box. Contact persons authorized to consent. You'll provide them with a document that describes the time, duration, personnel, locations, and all the good stuff that we talked about, and you'll get their signature on the document. And then you have written consent. In the materials that are on the web, you will find a simple written consent form, sort of a template that we use here in Region 3. It's not perfect, but it's a good starting place. You will also find a rather lengthy, complicated consent form. That's the last attachment, I believe, which is not where you want to start. But if you're looking for a place to start, I think it is tab number 6 in the materials. Okay, the third tool in that top box first column is the UAO, a unilateral administrative order. This is an order issued by an agency enforcement officer commanding access at the peril of penalties. By itself, and this is important, without an agreement to comply by the property owner, we do not have a legitimate access. Why? I hope you were all thinking Fourth Amendment, because that's the answer. The Fourth Amendment says we must have either consent or judicial approval. If the owner says no to the order, the Fourth Amendment says stop. But if the owner refuses to comply, we can seek court-ordered enforcement of the order and/or seek civil penalties for failure to comply. Advantages of the UAO. It's relatively fast, not as fast as oral or written consent. The entry terms will be memorialized. You know, it will be absolutely clear what we are requiring by way of access from the owner. It's somewhat readily modifiable. We are in control. We have to, you know, go through a modification process. A big advantage, there are penalties for violation of the order. I believe the current maximum is $37,500 a day for each day the owner violates that order. And it is enforceable in court. We can take this administrative order and evidence of the denial into court and say, dear judge, please issue a court order directing compliance with our administrative order. Now, there are disadvantages to the UAO. First, you need a denial of consent. Why? Because the statute says we have UAO authority only when there's a denial of consent or if we have conditions placed on consent. So says the NCP. Another disadvantage, it takes time to develop and issue it. Although some regions are quicker than others, we have done this in as little as a day or two. Headquarters involvement is necessary. The delegations require consultation with a specific office in the headquarters food chain before we can issue an administrative order for access. That's not typically a big deal. It's a phone call from your lawyer to the contact in headquarters. Another disadvantage comes from the enforcement area. We need DOJ to enforce it. We can't go into court ourselves and say, dear judge, please make them comply with our order. We need DOJ for that. And another disadvantage, this may compromise your dealings with the owner. Issuing a UAO might be regarded as an aggressive act against the owner. And if you've got a skittish owner who you need to be cooperative, this is not exactly going to make things hunky-dory between the two of you. How do you get a UAO? Well, first, you're going to document the denial of consent. Why? Because the statute says we need that. You're going to consult, or your lawyer is going to consult with OECA, that's the office that we are directed to consult with in the delegations. You're going to draft an order that describes the time, duration, the personnel, the locations, and all the good stuff that we talked about. You're also going to make sure that the order contains the terms that the NCP requires be present in administrative orders that we issue. You're going to get EPA to sign it. You're going to wait the end of the conference period that's built in. There must be a conference period built in, an opportunity for them to come in and moan to us. And then you're going to wait for a letter or some other indication of an agreement to comply. If you don't get that agreement to comply, you don't have access. So that's the UAO. Next, the fourth line on that first column, the court order, that's an Article 3 court order. This is a court order directing the owner to permit entry at the peril of civil or criminal contempt. It's issued by a judge. This is an Article 3 judge. Article 3 judges are picked by the president and confirmed by the Senate. So that's an Article 3 court order, and the difference between that and an Article 3 will be apparent in a few moments. Advantages of the Article 3 court order, the entry terms are going to be written down. The court's order will prescribe exactly what the property owner is required to do. It's enforceable by a judge. You go right back to the judge who issued it and say they're not complying. And you've got a much reduced risk of Fourth Amendment legitimacy because This is the judicial lead, not very useful. It takes forever to get one of these. DOJ involvement is necessary, and also you're probably going to compromise your dealings with the owner because you're suing the owner. How do we get an Article III court order? Look at the fourth column on the bottom box. First, document your denial of consent because the statute says we have to have this in order to pursue this path. We'll then make a referral to the Department of Justice. Justice, if they take the case, will file a complaint. There may be motions practice. There may be discovery. There may be more motions practice. There could be a trial, a verdict, post-trial motions. It takes forever. And it is not the path that will get you on to the site in a quick period of time. It is probably a tool of last resort. Okay, that is an Article III court order. Finally, we have the warrant. This, too, is a court order directing the owner to permit entry at the peril of civil or criminal contempt. It's issued not by an Article III judge, but by a federal magistrate. They aren't picked by the president and confirmed by the Senate. It's similar to the court order in its power, but it differs in the process that we use to get it. It's not an adversarial process. There is no complaint filed against the owner. We don't sue anybody. The owner does not have an opportunity to be heard or seen. Because of this, magistrates do not issue warrants for anything other than limited work that's short-term and low intrusion. That's one of the big disadvantages we'll get to. Advantages, the terms are memorialized because the warrant will, just like a court order or a UAO, expressly spell out precisely what the owner of the property is required to do. The warrant is court enforceable. You go back to the magistrate and say they've blown off a warrant. And again, there's a reduced risk of Fourth Amendment legitimacy because you're getting the judicial approval that you need. You've got no consent. Disadvantages, warrants are limited to short-term, low-intrusion work. No lengthy removal actions. We're talking about 30, maybe 60 days. No short-term removals with deep excavations or other stuff that's going to leave a mark on the land. What warrants are really suited for are sampling exercises, maybe the removal of some containers, maybe some minor surface contamination. It's going to depend on the feelings of the assistant U.S. attorney that you'll be in contact with to try to get the warrant. Another disadvantage of the warrant is DOJ involvement is necessary because we're engaging the judiciary. And again, this may also compromise dealings with the owner because you're going around the owner's back. How do we get a warrant? Well, we're going to make a referral to the Department of Justice, including affidavits, which is a very big piece of work that you, as the OSC or the RPM or the Site Assessment Manager, will play a very large part. The U.S. Attorney will apply for the warrant. We refer to Maine Justice, but in warrant cases, Maine Justice farms it out to the local U.S. Attorney's offices, and they know the local magistrates. There will be an ex parte hearing with the magistrate. Ex parte means it's just the government and the magistrate. The property owner does not get an opportunity to come in or be heard. Hopefully, the magistrate will sign the warrant. Then you can go into the field and do your work. Well, once the warrant's served. The warrant will be served by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Then you go out into the field and do your work. When that work is finished or when the warrant expires and warrants are issued for set periods of time, we have to engage in an exercise called a return of warrant where we report back to the magistrate, often on the phone and in writing, and say, we did X, Y, and Z pursuant to the authority of the warrant. Thanks very much. Sometimes, though, the magistrate has requested an in-camera, basically an appearance, by the same parties who showed up to get the warrant in the first place. So these are your tools. Consent, which can be oral or written, a UAO if access is denied, and again, it's not going to deliver access unless the property owner agrees to consent to the or agrees to comply with that order. You've got the Article 3 court order if access is denied, and you have a warrant for short-term low-intrusion work. Which of these tools should you use? It depends. If you don't have a denial of consent, neither issuing a UAO nor asking DOJ for court-ordered access under 104E5 of CERCLA is available to you.
Andy?
Yes.
Sorry to interject. I did have two questions. I just wanted to bring these up before you go any further.
Sure.
One of our participants wanted to know, is the process for getting access through a UAO or court order different when EPA is asked to get access for settling a defendant?
Well, that's a very good question. In many of our enforcement documents where we have a consent agreement for a removal action or in the remedial world, a consent decree for remedial action, which private parties will do the work, there will typically be an access provision that requires that they, the PRPs, get access. That access provision will also say, if you can't get access after expending best efforts, you come back to EPA and EPA will get access. We would use the same tools that we just covered to get the access for ourselves and then designate the PRPs as our access representatives solely for the work to be done.
Okay. And then our next question asks, is the warrant served to the property owner or the tenants or to both of them in some cases?
That's also a very interesting question, and I'm going to say the U.S. attorney would probably do well to serve the both, especially in the cases that I mentioned before where if by chance a magistrate allows us, issues a warrant that allows us to do vapor intrusion sampling, for example, even though you know, we're going to be doing some damage by drilling a hole through the foundation, I would recommend that the owner to come back and say, well, this is ridiculous. The government served a warrant on the tenant who then agreed to allow the government to come in, do work that the tenant didn't have authority to consent to in the first place. Remember, even if we have a warrant in hand, if the property owner can say no, the consequences of saying no are a heck of a lot bigger in that case, but we don't pull our guns out and start kicking in doors. We run back to the magistrate or to the Article 3 judge. So we want to make sure that, you know, we've got that piece of paper, but we also have the consent, that the person with, you know, control of the property understands that we're there, understands that we have the warrant, and doesn't stand in the way. So that's a long-winded answer to say I think service should be to both in those examples that I made before where the tenant may not have the authority to consent. But if it doesn't fall into one of those categories, we could probably get away with, you know, serving only the tenant.
Okay, just a real quick time check. We have about 39 minutes left, and you're on slide number 27.
Okay, good. All right, which tool are you going to use? It's going to depend. I said, If you don't have your denial of consent, the UAO and any other remedy under 104E5 is not going to work for you. If you need long-term access or short-term access for very intrusive work that's going to leave a mark, the warrant may not be available. Beyond this, you have some factors to consider. How quickly do you need access? Well, speed favors oral or written consent. What type of work are you doing and for how long? A warrant may be out of the question for something that's long-term and intrusive. Will the work area change? Well, this favors flexibility and ease of modification. Can you find someone who's authorized to consent? If not, the consent tools won't be an option. A warrant might. This might be a good time to inject the idea that we're also, in addition to asking DOJ to file an action against the property owner, we can ask DOJ to file an action against the property itself. So even if we cannot come up with a live body to ask consent from, we can file an action. It would be In Re 100 acres located on Smith Boulevard. That's an alternative means of getting a court order if we can't come up with an actual live person. How reliable will the consent be, and what are the consequences of revocation? Are you dealing with an owner who changes his or her mind every 5 minutes? Are you using equipment that is available to you for a 2-day period, and then it's off back to Las Vegas? These are some of the things that you need to think about when you discuss which tool might be best suited for the access that you need. Talk with your lawyer about which of these to use. I would say that the vast majority of time, you're going to use written consent. If consent is not provided, in most cases, we're going to get you a warrant, as long as what we're talking about is short-term work and it's low intrusion work. For longer projects, we may need to go down the longer path using the slower methods, but I think most of the time, you guys are going to get oral or written consent, and I would argue you should be pushing for written consent because it's cleaner. You're going to get consent from the owner, and we'll be able to get you on with a written consent document or a warrant. Okay. Big breath. Remember I told you that in order to enter private property in a manner that's consistent with the Fourth Amendment, you need either consent of the owner or judicial approval. Well, there is a small body of legal doctrines which stands as an exception to this general rule. They derive from U.S. Supreme Court cases that are interpreted, sometimes inconsistently, by local courts. Knowledge of the local case law interpreting these exceptions is essential to making an informed decision about whether or not one of these is going to work for you. You should not be using these doctrines without first consulting with and getting the assent from the lawyers in your office who know something about them. What am I talking about? The three doctrines, there are actually more than three, but three doctrines that are called warrant, the exceptions to the warrant rule that would apply in waste cleanups. I'm talking about open fields, exigent circumstances, and community caretaking. And I'm not going to spend more than 15 seconds on each. Open fields recognizes that there are certain areas, such as commercial properties or portions of residential properties outside what's called the curtilage of the home, where property owners have no reasonable expectation of privacy. An example, the surface of the ground inside a fenced area that's adjacent to a house. Ironically, though it's called open fields, it doesn't have to be open, it can be fenced, and it doesn't have to be a field. Determining factor is whether the owner has reasonable expectation of privacy that society is willing to recognize. And for that, you need to consult with your lawyer. Exigent circumstances. While open fields talked about certain areas, exigent circumstances talks about certain circumstances that present a compelling need where there's no time for consent and no time for court approval. Example, the firefighters entering the property to put out the blaze. Note that the time frame for the existence of exigent circumstances may be very, very limited, depending on what you want to do. And in the case that gave rise to exigent circumstances, it was okay for the firefighters to go in without consent or judicial approval to put out the blaze. But it was not okay for them to go back to look for clues as to how the fire started. Again, you're going to need to talk with your lawyer. And the third exception, community caretaking. Open fields talked about certain areas. Exigent circumstances talked about certain circumstances. Community caretaking talks about certain actions, focused measures to protect public health, avoid injury, abate a nuisance, diffuse a situation. Warrantless, consentless entry was deemed okay under the community caretaking doctrine. I can't stress enough, application of these are fact-dependent, and the parameters of each doctrine are going to vary from one jurisdiction to another. Some jurisdictions don't recognize some of these exceptions, so you absolutely need to coordinate with a lawyer in your office who knows something about this if you're going to rely on it. All right, with the time that...
We have one more question. Sorry.
Sure.
One of our participants would like to know what actions may be taken when long-term access is required and an authorized person cannot be located.
Well, again, I mentioned before, we can file it. We can ask the Attorney General to file an in rem action against the property. That is, we would, instead of filing against the property owner, you know, Andy Goldman, we'd file against the property, 123 Smith Boulevard. Notice will be affected in if the person's not around, deceased, what have you, they will not answer the complaint. We will move for a summary judgment or a default judgment, and that will constitute, if it's granted, our court-ordered access. So that's in most instances where we need long-term access and there is no property owner, that is the way it will be handled. We will seek an in rem action, which is going down the get a court order path from an Article III judge.
Okay, thank you.
All right. With the remaining time, 30 minutes, I wanted to cover three topics. I'm not sure I'm going to get to all three, but we'll see how we make out. The first is common requested access conditions and recommended responses. The second is entry to railroads and other dangerous places. And the third is access in the context of Stafford Act disaster emergencies. I'm going to start with common requests and recommended responses. When you ask for consent, you're going to often receive requests for concessions to protect the interests of the owner. Put yourselves in the shoes of a property owner. If a government agent asked you for permission to take samples in your yard, you'd naturally be concerned about liability if somebody gets hurt, who's paying for the samples, what about disruption to the yard, whether your yard's going to be restored. This is a natural reaction that should not come unexpected to you as an on-scene coordinator or an RPM. But remember, we're not required to make concessions under CERCLA. The NCP equates conditions with a denial of consent. And our access policy specifically prohibits us from making concessions which would restrict or impede your response or impose indemnity or compensatory obligations or operate as a release of liability. As I said before, we typically say no except to costless concessions. Concessions that don't delay the response, that don't make the response more difficult or expensive. Examples of costless concessions include providing advance notice before the entry, providing a copy of our contractor's insurance certificate provided it doesn't contain CBI, providing a copy of the sampling plan. Well, here on this chart, this slide, are some typical requests and how we handle them. And the print is really small on this panel. Let's say the owner wants to be named as an additional insured on a contractor on its policies. On our contractor's policies, where the owner wants EPA to obtain additional insurance, which is something that we frequently encounter at railroads. Well, our position is the government is self-insured. Our contractors are obligated by law and by their contracts to carry certain coverages. We have no authority to request or require that contractors purchase more or different insurance. And naming additional insureds on the contractor's policy will dilute the coverage that they've got that protects us from liability. So what we do will say in that situation is exactly what I said, and we will provide them with a copy of the insurance certificates that the contractors have, provided that they are CBI cleared. We will not, however, provide them with a copy of the insurance policy, because even we don't have that. Nor will we make any assurances that there are no exemptions or exclusions in the insurance that might be triggered by virtue of the work that we're going to do on the property. But when it comes to insurance, there's very little that we're capable of doing, and providing an insurance certificate is really just that. Property restoration. The owners want the property restored. Well, the position that we have is that the statute says Superfund money can be used only for specified purposes. I think you'll find that in Section 109. There's a law out there called the Anti-Deficiency Act that prohibits us from entering into contracts where appropriated funds are not available to fulfill them. The example that I give in this case usually is you get access, or you want access, to a beautiful home with a fabulous Italian marble fountain in the front yard. And They want your assurance that you will restore the property to the original condition. And your contractor clips that Italian marble fountain, and the cost to repair is $250,000. Your entire removal budget may be $250,000. You cannot agree to restore the property into the original condition. The Anti-Deficiency Act prohibits it. What we do say is that the owner retains the right to sue us under another law called the Federal Tort Claims Act, where they can pursue damages from the government. So we will not agree to restore property. What we would say, or may agree to, is that we intend to leave the property as we found it. Now, that only works if you actually do intend to leave the property as you found it. If you're going to install a culvert or a cap, you want to say, except for the cap or the culverts, we intend to leave the property as we found it. It is not a legal commitment. It is the expression of an intention. All right, advance notice of entry. The owner wants X days notice prior to each entry that we make. Doesn't sound like a big concession, though it may be burdensome if entry is going to occur over a number of days where the owner is difficult to contact. We don't want the owner's ill entry if we're talking about a multi-day entry. By calling a specified phone number, advising the person who answers the phone of our entry, or leaving a message. You want to fashion an advance notice provision that's not going to allow the owner to engineer a delay by being absent. And you're going to work with your lawyer to figure out how best to do that. All right, a release of liability. The owner wants CPA to agree that we can that we enter and conduct a response at our own cost, or they want us to agree that they are not liable. The answer is, I should hear you all screaming, no. Another one, indemnity and hold harmless. The owner wants EPA to agree that if the owner gets sued for injuries or damages arising from our entry, we will reimburse them for the damages and or defend them in that lawsuit. I should hear a resounding no from you all. The owner wants approval over sample locations. No. How about if the owner wants a copy of the results? Well, the statute, remember, requires that we provide them with a copy of the results. So what I'd like to do in the written agreements is to parrot the language of the statute. EPA intends to provide the owner with a copy of the results of any analyses of samples taken under the consent provided herein as required by 42 U.S.C. 9604 E4B. That takes care of that. Sometimes the owners say, I want to accompany you when you're on site. Well, we don't want the owner's, you know, non-presence to delay the project. So what we can come back with is the owner may accompany us on site if the OSC determines that it's safe. This is just a very short list of common requests by the owners. You're likely to see many others. You're going to work with your lawyers to determine an appropriate response to any of these requests. And especially if you're coming up with a workaround, you're going to want your lawyer involved in fashioning the language on that agreement. All right. Remember I said a few moments ago that EPA generally makes no real concessions in the access context. Well, for every exception, or I'm sorry, for every rule there is an exception, and this is no exception. There is a special class of cases where we're typically willing to go above and beyond our normal round of costless concessions. The special class includes railroads, airports, power plants, or any other really dangerous place where a misstep on our part could result in extraordinary injury or damages. Now, this is not formal written policy. This is a feature of Region 3's access practice based on years of negotiating access with railroads. And in these cases, we'll make safety-related concessions. The thought here is that the owner or operator of the airport or the railroad knows where its equipment is located, how that equipment operates, what conditions have to exist for the equipment to operate properly, and the risks presented by what we want to do on the property. So we will agree in those contexts to safety-related conditions like these. Paying for or obeying flag people, so we don't get ourselves or other people killed on active rail track. paying for the review of our plans so we don't cut through an underground signal or destabilize track causing a derailment or a crash. We'll agree to restrictions on track crossing so we don't damage the track by crossing with one of those tracked front-end loaders and ruin the rail causing a derailment. We'll agree to restrictions on where we put our stuff so we don't have trains hitting our stuff, damaging it, and injuring or killing people. We'll agree to pre-entry coordination with railroad personnel so that they are aware of the work that we want to do there, and they themselves can impose temporary train rules, for example, so that the trains slow down to 5 miles an hour and toot their horns before they pass through the work zone. Also, so that we know what the train schedule is and know how frequently we're going to have to pay greater attention. We'll also agree to comply with health and safety plans as long as we see what's in them in advance. So we're, for example, wearing the right kind of protection that the railroad workers will recognize and be able to see. So these are examples of the safety-related conditions that we're likely to agree to in these dangerous places. We will not, however, make concessions to address financial or liability concerns. For example, we won't agree to indemnify them or hold them harmless. We won't agree to additional insurance policies or naming them as an additional insured. We won't agree to pay processing or application fees or release them from liability or conduct the work at our own expense. We won't submit to the jurisdiction of a court for enforcement. And you should not be making safety-related concessions without getting the advice of counsel who will also provide you with the language that you're going to need. In the handouts, tab 7 is a very complicated access agreement that we in Region 3 negotiated with the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, that's SEPTA. That's the regional rail authority that runs the commuter rail in this portion of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. This was an agreement to enter active track where the regional commuter rail passed to excavate soil contamination that was in close proximity to the track. We agreed in this complex agreement to significant advanced coordination with SEPTA engineers. We agreed to obey flag protection. We agreed on restrictions on where we could place our equipment. We agreed to comply with their safety rules that were provided to us in advance so we knew what they were. And we agreed to attend SEPTA safety classes in advance of our entry. Now, had they not been boneheads and forced us to issue a unilateral order to do the work, what it really involved was sampling first. And when they said no and insisted that we provide them with railroad protection insurance, it's a special type of policy, we, after weeks of discussing this, banging our heads on the wall, issued a UAO directing them to take the samples themselves. They crawled back to us and said, please rescind the order. We'll agree to a written consent format. Had they not taken us through that, we would have been prepared to pay them to review our plans and pay them for the flag protection costs, but we didn't have to. So take a look at tab 7 in the handouts to get an idea of how far we've gone. All right, with the 20 minutes that remain, looks like we will get the Stafford Act. Some of you may be aware that in times of disaster affecting many people in locations where state and local governments are overwhelmed, for example, Hurricane Katrina, the U.S. government has provided assistance. The modern-day mechanism under which the assistance is provided was set up in legislation called the Stafford Act. It's named after Robert Stafford, who was the governor, congressman, and later the senator of Vermont. The Stafford Act is a 1988 law intending to, quote, provide an orderly and continuing means of assistance by the federal government to state and local governments in carrying out their responsibilities to alleviate the suffering and damage which results from disasters. And this is accomplished through a number of instruments, revising and broadening existing relief programs, encouraging state and local governments to develop comprehensive disaster plans, improving coordination and responsiveness, encouraging acquisition of insurance, encouraging hazard mitigation measures, and providing federal assistance programs for public and private losses sustained in disasters. Now, under the Stafford Act, The U.S. government swings into action after issuance of a presidential disaster declaration following a request by a state governor. The president's authority to provide assistance and relief has been delegated to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. FEMA then is responsible for making decisions about what assistance is going to be provided and which federal agencies will participate in that effort. FEMA does this through the issuance of mission assignments, directing federal agencies to take on specific tasks. FEMA is going to do this in accordance with what's called the National Response Framework, which is a blueprint used by the U.S. government to respond to emergencies and disasters. Now, this National Response Framework groups federal assistance in transportation, communications, public works and engineering, firefighting. You can read on down that list. Pay particular note to item ESF number 10, which is oil and hazardous materials response. Now, for each one of these 15 emergency support functions, the framework designates one or more primary agencies and numerous support agencies. And as you can see, EPA is the ESF coordinator and one of two primary agencies identified for ESF 10. That's oil and hazardous materials response. This draws in the type of things that we do under the NCP. Well, as if this wasn't enough, EPA also has support agency responsibility under a number of other emergency support functions, numbers 3, 4, 5, 8, 11, 12, and 14. So there may be a huge variety of activities that EPA is called upon to do in a mission assignment that may give rise to a need to enter private property. Now, getting back to the Stafford Act, Section 403 authorizes the president, delegated to FEMA, to provide assistance essential in meeting immediate threats to life and property, including performing on public or private lands or waters any work or services essential to saving lives and protecting, preserving property or public health and safety, which includes things like debris removal, search and rescue, road clearance, demo, dissemination of public information, technical advice, and reduction of immediate threats to life, property, and public health and safety. Now, of all of the actions that are described in the Stafford Act, I found only one that we routinely engage in and which contains any hint of access authority or procedure, and that is debris removal. Section 407A1 says the president is authorized through use of federal departments, agencies, and instrumentalities to clear debris and wreckage resulting from a major disaster from publicly and privately owned lands and waters. 407B of that provision says, no authority under this section shall be executed, and this is the important stuff, this is good for us, unless the affected state or local government shall first arrange an unconditional authorization for removal of such debris or wreckage from public and private property. So it's clear that if we receive a mission assignment to engage in debris removal on private property, access should not be an issue for us. The Act requires that the state or local government prearrange access so we don't need to worry about it. Okay, I hear many of you wondering, what if we are called upon to do stuff that goes beyond debris removal? Well, for that, FEMA's regulations come to the rescue. All right?
I'm not advancing. Let's try this again. There.
44 CFR 206-208 is the relevant provision. In subsection A, it's the regulations say when the state and local government lacks the capability to perform or to contract for eligible emergency work, they may request that the work be accomplished by a federal agency. Subsection B is the good stuff. All requests for direct federal assistance shall be submitted by the grantee to the regional director, that's of FEMA, and shall include a written agreement that the state will, and here it is, provide without cost to the U.S. all lands, easements, and rights of way necessary to accomplish the approved work. So when it comes to Stafford Act access, we should not be concerned. If all goes as planned, and according to the statute and the regulations, access should be prearranged for us. And that takes us to the end. The summary, the takeaways, beyond the two big takeaways that I announced at the beginning. Officials acting outside their authority may cause unintended consequences, and we went over what they were, and they include personal liability. Look to the U.S. Constitution and the case law, the statute and the case law, delegations, regulations, policy and guidance document, and site-specific documents for the source and limits on your authorities. Entry and inspection under Superfund invokes the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, CERCLA 104E1, 3, and 4, Executive Order 12580, and the Headquarters and Your Own Regional Delegation 14-6, Section 300-400D of the NCP, access guidance documents, and what's not there, site-specific documents as well, such as a warrant or that Dear EPA, no access. Gather key information before seeking access. You want to do this before you go to the knock on the door of the property owner or the door for your lawyer. Access can be secured via oral consent, written consent, administrative orders, Article 3 court orders, or warrants. And contact your lawyer if you're uncertain at any point regarding your authority to enter. That's why we are here. Please. Contact us. Even if you think it's a dumb question, it isn't a dumb question. Are there any questions? Keeping in mind that there are no dumb questions.
Well, right now, I have the participants can continue to type up your comments and questions. We do have a little bit of time left. I've got two that have come into the queue, and we'll continue to wait to see if we have a few others. While we're waiting, let me pose this question. One of our participants would like to know, to assure that we are covered, how should we confirm that we do indeed have access in a Stafford Act debris removal?
I was afraid that might get asked. The answer is not entirely clear. There are a couple ways of doing it. Depending on how it's all set up, you can go to your engage your lawyer, who should be familiar with the way the Stafford Act works, should be familiar with the contacts that need to be made in order to ensure that the state or local government has done what it needs to do. Alternatively, the OSC can go up his or her chain of command to do the same thing. That's probably the best advice that I can give at this point. Outside that, absolutely being concerned is a natural and legitimate thing. Especially from an access standpoint, with the prearrangements that the Stafford Act and the FEMA regulations seemingly require.
Okay, our next question. Do I need to get access to respond to a life-threatening emergency response?
Well, initially I would say yes. Remember, you are authorized to act only if you can act only if you're authorized to act, and if you want to enter property, you need to satisfy the entry conditions. And remember, look to where, we derive our authority and our limits from, and the Fourth Amendment is certainly one of them. So, yes, in an emergency situation, you're going to need proper access, but in a true dire emergency situation where you've got the green chlorine cloud drifting over to the daycare with the kids in the yard and you can't find the owner and you can't get to the magistrate or the court on time, we may be able to argue exigent circumstances. But that's after the fact. What you're going to do in those circumstances is you're going to call your lawyer, you're going to give the lawyer all the facts, like the green cloud, the kids playing next door, the efforts that you've undertaken to identify the owner and everything else, and get advice of counsel as to whether exigent circumstances is viable. Assuming it is, the lawyer will say, I believe this qualifies as exigent circumstances, and you will go in without consent, without judicial approval, and do your business. if at the end of the day the property owner wants to bring a Fourth Amendment claim against everybody, including you as the OSC, they're going to do that. But we will argue exigent circumstances existed and the case should be dismissed. So that's how that would play out. But as I said, it's very, very fact dependent.
Okay. We have another participant that would like to know, can a site owner revoke an access agreement at any time?
The answer to that is absolutely. Whether it be a oral consent or written consent or consent, you know, a agreement to comply with a unilateral order or even in the face of a court order or a warrant, the property owner can say, get off my land. We are not the we don't self-enforce. So we don't get out shotguns and say we're here and we're staying. We consider that a situation in which we have, at least for the moment, lost access and need to reacquire access. If it's a warrant, we will run to the magistrate. If it's an Article III court order, we will run to the Article III judge. If it's a unilateral order, you will run to your lawyer, and we will, you know, try to get an Article III judge to get enforcement. More likely, though, you'll run to your lawyer first, and your lawyer will engage with the property owner's lawyer to try to get it, you know, taken care of. But absolutely, property owners, property rights very heavily protected, and access is not permanent. It's not. We don't have a monopoly on it. We are there as guests, and they have every right to revoke the access. The only question is, what are the potential consequences to the owner for that revocation?
Okay. We also have another participant that commented, the state conducts our site assessment activities under a cooperative agreement, so they are the ones who are actually getting access. I often accompany them on the recon and sampling events, and I had not been getting individual access agreements for myself. It sounds like I need to have a separate access agreement as an EPA OSC.
That is absolutely true. While we frequently include the state in our access agreements, the states cannot include us. They do not have the authority to get access for federal employees to engage in work under a federal statute. So we should not be relying on access obtained by the state. Federal officials are acting under a federal statute with federal limits and conditions and need to get access for themselves.
Okay. I don't see any more electronic questions that have been submitted. I do have a few final reminders and close-up statements that I'll need to share with the audience, but Andrew, are there any other things you'd like to say before we start the close-out procedures?
No, I thank you for the opportunity to discuss these issues with you. If anyone has any follow-up questions, I believe my phone number is in the materials. Feel free to telephone me. I would recommend that you go to your lawyer, your own lawyers first, but I have, after readiness conferences, received phone calls from other regions. I welcome that.
Okay, great. Well, I want to echo your thanks. We did have about 40 individuals join us for today's live broadcast. And I'm just going to go through a couple of closeout reminders. If you are participating today and need a physical or electronic copy of a training certificate that you can print for your own training records for this particular seminar series, the CEC Training for OSCs, we are issuing electronic certificates that you can print out. You'll simply need to send an email to Austin at Tetra Tech, and she will verify that you participated and submitted feedback for today's seminar, and she'll email you one of those electronic certificates. Notice I said she'll verify that you will submit feedback for today's session. Well, you may be asking, how do I do that? Well, there is a hyperlink that I shared in the Q&A window. It's also available under related URLs. It takes just a moment to fill that form out, and we will be using that as part of a way to confirm that you participated live or at least replayed the recording and shared feedback after the live delivery. If you shared the line with multiple individuals at your particular location, Each person can submit their own feedback form. And one thing I'll draw your attention to, if you fill that feedback form out, there's a box you can check that you can actually have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records, which will further verify that you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So just make sure you very carefully enter in your email address and check that box, and you should get a confirmation message as soon as you share feedback. And then you can email Austin, and we'll get you an actual electronic certificate for your own records. If you want to download any of the resources that were mentioned or the presentation materials or even that handy little movie clip that we used, again, you'll find all of that on the resources or links page. Again, that's under related URLs in the Adobe Connect room. It's also available on the seminar homepage. The feedback form and additional links and resources will be available from this point forward, and you're welcome to certainly download materials as needed. As Andy mentioned, his contact information is available on the seminar homepage. You can feel free to email him or myself if you have any outstanding questions. Again, thank you to those who were able to join us live from across the U.S. here at EPA. And I also want to echo my thanks for the organizers as well as Andy for taking his time today and delivering a really informative session today. This will be archived, and again, we're working on internal access for EPA employees. We will automatically send an email to all registrants as soon as that internal recording link is available. If you need something immediately, though, feel free to reach out to me at ballant.gene@epa.gov immediately, and I'll work with you to get an immediate access link. That's the end of the closing reminders that I have for everyone today, so be sure to take a moment to share your thoughts on the live delivery, and I think I hope that we'll see you on either a future, or we'll hear from you on a future Clue and Internet seminar.